I asked for this one simple thing. You know how much it meant to me. I don't owe you anything, Will said with quiet fury. I've been covering for you for the past 8 months. I'm tired of Marcus playing us. You need to do the right thing. You need to tell the truth. Things have changed. Will turned and strode to the door. As he pushed it open, he heard Scott behind him. What did you do? Will turned, holding the door half open and meeting Scott's gaze with steely intent. Like I said, you need to tell the truth. He waited until Scott absorbed his words, then stepped out, letting the door slam shut behind him. As he made his way past the cars on lifts, he could hear Scott calling after him. You want to ruin my life? You want me to go to jail for an accident? I'm not going to do that. Even as he neared the lobby, he could still hear Scott slamming his hand into the lockers.
Chapter 29. Ronnie. The next week was tense for both of them. Ronnie wasn't comfortable with the violence she'd seen Will display. Nor was she entirely comfortable with the way it had made her feel. She didn't like fights. She didn't like to see people get hurt. And she knew that it rarely improved a situation. Yet, she couldn't force herself to be angry at Will for what he'd done. As much as she didn't want to condone what happened, watching Will completely dismantle the three of them made her feel just a bit safer when she was with him. But Will was stressed. He was certain that Marcus would report what had happened and that the police would come knocking at his door any minute. But Ronnie sensed that something else was bothering him, something he wasn't letting on. For some reason, he and Scott weren't on speaking terms, and she wondered whether that had something to do with Will's unease. Then, of course, there was the family, particularly Will's mother. Ronnie had seen her twice since the wedding. Once as she waited in the truck at Will's house while Will ran inside to pick up a clean shirt, and once at a restaurant in downtown Wilmington when Will took her out. As they'd taken their seats, Susan had walked in with a group of her friends. Ronnie had a perfect view of the entrance, but Will was facing in the other direction. On both occasions, Susan had pointedly turned her back to Ronnie. She hadn't told Will about either incident. While Will was lost in his own world of retribution and worry, Ronnie noticed that Susan seemed to believe Ronnie was somehow personally responsible for the tragedy that had befallen Blaze. As she stood in her bedroom, she watched Will's sleeping figure from a distance. He was curled up near the turtle's nest. Because a few of the other nests had begun to hatch, they'd removed the cage this afternoon, and the nest was completely exposed. Neither of them felt good about leaving it unattended for the night. And because Will was spending less and less time at home anyway, he'd volunteered to watch it. She didn't want to think about their newfound troubles, but she found herself replaying all that had happened this summer. She could barely remember the girl she'd been when she'd first arrived at the beach. And the summer wasn't over yet. In a couple of days, she'd turn 18. And after one last weekend together, Will would be leaving for college. Her next court appearance was scheduled a few days after that, and then she'd have to go back to New York. So much already done, and so much left to do. She shook her head. Who was she? And whose life was she leading? More than that, where would it take her? These days, none of it and all of it felt real, more real than anything she'd known. Her love for Will, her growing bond with her father. The way her life had slowed down so simply and completely. All of it sometimes seemed to be happening to someone else, someone she was still getting to know. Never in a million years would she have considered the idea that a sleepy beach town somewhere in the South would have been filled with so much more life and drama than Manhattan. Smiling, she had to admit that with a few exceptions, it hadn't been all that bad either. She was sleeping in a quiet bedroom beside her brother, separated only by glass and sand from the young man she loved, a young man who loved her back. She wondered whether there could be anything greater in life. And despite all that had happened, maybe because of it, she knew she would never forget the summer they'd spent together, no matter what the future might bring. Lying in bed, she began to drift off to sleep. Her last conscious thought was that there was more coming. Although that sensation often foretold the worst, she knew that couldn't be possible, not after all they'd been through. In the morning, however, she awoke feeling anxious. As always, she was acutely conscious of the fact that another day had passed, meaning one less day left with Will. But as she lay there, trying to make sense of the unease she felt, she realized it wasn't just that. Will was heading off to college next week. Even Kayla was heading off to college. Yet, she still had no idea what was coming for her. Yeah, she'd turn 18. And yeah, she'd deal with whatever the court decided. But then what? Was she going to live with her mom forever? Should she apply for a job at Starbucks? For an instant, she flashed on an image of her holding a shovel and following behind elephants at the zoo. It was the first time she confronted the future so directly. She'd always held to the breezy belief that everything would turn out okay, no matter what she decided. And it would, she knew, for a while. But did she still want to be living with her mom at 19? Or 21? Or, God forbid, 25? And how on earth was someone supposed to earn enough on her own and afford to live in Manhattan without a college degree? She didn't know. All she knew for certain was that she wasn't ready for the summer to end. She wasn't ready to go back home. She wasn't ready to think about Will wandering the green quads at Vanderbilt, walking beside co-eds in cheerleader outfits. She didn't want to think about any of it. "Is everything okay? You've been kind of quiet," Will said. "I'm sorry," she said. "It's just that I've got a lot on my mind." They were sitting at the pier, sharing bagels and coffee, which they'd picked up on the way. Usually the pier was crowded with people fishing, but this morning they had the place to themselves. A nice surprise, considering he had the day off. "Have you given any thought to what you want to do?" "Anything that doesn't involve elephants and shovels." He balanced his bagel on the styrofoam cup. "Do I want to know what you're talking about?" "Probably not," she said, grimacing. "Okay," he nodded. "But I was talking about what you wanted to do for your birthday tomorrow." Ronnie shrugged. "It doesn't have to be anything special." "But you're turning 18. Face it, that's a big deal. You'll legally be an adult." Great, she thought. Yet another reminder that time was running out to figure out what she was going to do with her life. Will must have read her expression because he reached over to put a hand on her knee. "Did I say something wrong?" "No, I don't know. I'm just feeling weird today." In the distance, a pod of porpoises broke the water beyond the swells. The first time she'd seen them, she'd been amazed. Even the 20th. Now, they were a regular part of the scenery. But even so, she'd missed them when she was back in New York, doing whatever it was she was going to do. She'd probably end up addicted to cartoons like Jonah, and insist on watching them upside down. "How about I take you out to dinner?" No, scratch that. She'd probably end up addicted to Game Boy. "Okay. Or maybe we'll go dancing? Or maybe Guitar Hero? Jonah liked to play that for hours. And so would Rick, now that she thought about it. Pretty much everyone without a life was addicted to that game. Sounds fine. Or how about this? We paint our faces and try to summon ancient Incan goddesses." Addicted to those lousy games, she'd probably still be living at home when Jonah went off to college in 8 years. "Whatever you want." The sound of Will's laughter was enough to bring her attention back to him. "Did you say something?" "Your birthday. I was trying to figure out what you want for your birthday, but obviously you're out in Never Never Land." "I'm leaving on Monday. And I want to do something special for you." She thought about it before turning toward the house, noticing again how out of place it was along this stretch of beach. You know what I really, really want? It didn't happen on her birthday, but two nights later. Friday, August 22nd, was close enough. The staff at the aquarium really did have the whole thing down to a science. Earlier that afternoon, workers and volunteers from the aquarium had begun to prepare the area so the turtles could reach the water safely. She and Will had helped smooth the sand in the shallow trench that led to the ocean. Others had put up caution tape to keep the crowd at a safe distance. Most of the crowd, anyway. Her dad and Jonah had been allowed inside the taped area, and they were standing off to the side, out of the way of the bustling workers. Ronnie didn't have any idea what she was supposed to do, other than make sure no one got too close to the nest. It wasn't as if she were an expert, but when she wore the Easter egg-colored aquarium outfit, people assumed she knew everything. She must have answered 100 questions in the last hour. She was pleased she'd been able to remember the things Will had first told her about the turtles, and also relieved that she'd taken a few minutes to review the loggerhead fact card the aquarium had printed up for onlookers. Pretty much everything that people wanted to know was already there in black and white, but she supposed it was easier to ask her than glance at the card they held in their hands. It also helped to pass the time. They'd already been out here for hours, and though they'd been reassured that the nest might begin to hatch any minute, Ronnie wasn't so certain. The turtles didn't care that some of the little kids might be getting tired, or that someone might have to get up early to go to work the next morning. Somehow she'd imagined that there would be only half a dozen people out here, not the hundreds massing all along the caution tape. She wasn't sure she liked it. It kind of made the whole thing feel like a circus. As she took a seat on the dune, Will came over to her. "What do you think?" he asked, gesturing at the scene. "I'm not sure yet. Nothing's happened so far." "It's not going to be long now." "So I keep being told." Will took a seat beside her. "You need to learn patience, young grasshopper."
"I am patient. I just want the hatching to happen sooner rather than later."
He laughed.
"My mistake. Shouldn't you be working?"
"I'm just a volunteer. You're the one who actually works at the aquarium."
"Yes, but I'm not being paid for my time, and technically, since you're a volunteer, I think you should man the caution tape for a while."
"Let me guess. Half the people ask what's going on, and the other half ask questions that are answered on the card you hand them?"
"Pretty much."
"And you're tired of that?"
"Let's just say that it wasn't as much fun as dinner the other night." He'd taken her out to a cozy little Italian place for her birthday. He'd also bought her a silver necklace with a silver turtle pendant, which she loved and had been wearing ever since.
"How do you know when it's almost time?"
He pointed to the head of the aquarium and one of the biologists on staff.
"When Elliot and Todd start getting excited."
"Sounds pretty scientific."
"Oh, it is. Trust me."
"Mind if I join you?"
After Will had gone off to retrieve some extra flashlights from the truck, her dad had walked over.
"You don't have to ask, Dad. Of course you can."
"I didn't want to bother you. You look sort of preoccupied."
"I'm just waiting, like everyone else," she said. She moved over, making room as he took a seat beside her. The crowd had gotten even larger in the last half hour, and she was glad her dad had been allowed inside the caution tape. Lately, he looked so tired.
"Believe it or not, growing up, I never saw a nest hatch."
"Why not?"
"It just wasn't the big deal it is now. I mean, I'd sometimes stumble across a nest and think it was neat, but I never thought much about it.
The closest I ever came to seeing an actual hatching was coming across a nest the day after it happened. I saw all the broken shells around the nest, but it was just part of life around here. In any case, I bet this isn't what you expected, huh? All these people around?"
"What do you mean?"
"Between you and Will, you watch that nest every night, keeping it safe.
And now that the exciting part is about to happen, you have to share it with everyone.
That's okay. I don't mind.
Even a little?
She smiled. It was amazing how well her dad had come to know her.
How's your song coming?
It's a work in progress.
I've probably written 100 variations of it so far, but it's still not right. I know it's kind of a pointless exercise. If I haven't figured it out yet, I probably never will. But it gives me something to do.
I saw the window this morning. It's almost done.
Her dad nodded.
It's getting close.
Have they figured out when they're going to install it?
No, he said. Still waiting for the money for the rest of the church. They don't want to put it in until the place is being used.
Pastor Harris is worried some vandals might throw rocks at it. The fire has made him a lot more cautious about everything.
I'd probably be cautious, too. Steve straightened his legs out on the sand, then drew them back in, wincing.
Are you okay? She asked.
Just been standing too much these last few days. Jonah wants to finish the window before he leaves.
He's had a good time this summer.
Yeah?
He told me the other night that he doesn't want to go back to New York, that he wants to stay with you.
He's a sweet kid, he said.
He hesitated before turning toward her.
I guess the next question is whether you had a good time this summer.
Yeah, I did.
Because of Will?
Because of everything, she said. I'm glad we spent time together.
Me too.
So when's your next trip to New York?
Oh, I don't know. We'll play that by ear.
She smiled.
Too busy these days?
Not hardly, he said.
But you want to know something?
What's that?
I think you're a terrific young lady. I never want you to forget how proud I am of you.
What brought that up?
I wasn't sure I'd told you that lately.
She rested her head on his shoulder.
You're okay too, Dad.
Hey,
he said, motioning to the nest.
I think it's starting.
She turned toward the nest, then scrambled to her feet.
As Will had predicted, Elliot and Todd were moving around with great excitement while a hush came over the crowd. It unfolded the way Will had originally described it, except that words didn't really do it justice. Because she was able to get so close, she could see it all. The first egg beginning to crack open, followed by another and then another. All the eggs seemingly wiggling on their own until the first turtle actually emerged and began to scramble over the wiggling eggs and out of the nest. Still, it was what followed that was most amazing. First a little movement, then some movement, and then so much movement that it was impossible for the eye to capture it all as 5 and then 10 and then 20 and then too many turtles to count joined in a massive frenzy of activity, like a crazy beehive on steroids. And then there was the sight of the tiny prehistoric-looking turtles trying to escape the hole, clawing their way up and slipping back down, crawling over the tops of one another, until one finally got out, followed by a second, and then a third, all moving along the sandy trench toward the light Todd was holding as he stood in the surf. One by one, Ronnie watched them crawling past, thinking them so incredibly small that survival seemed almost inconceivable. The ocean would simply swallow them up, making them disappear, which was exactly what happened as they reached the water and were tossed and rolled in the surf, bobbing briefly to the surface before vanishing from sight. She'd stood beside Will, squeezing his hand tightly, immensely happy that she'd spent all those nights by the nest, and that she'd played some small part in this miracle of new life. It was incredible to think that after weeks of absolutely nothing happening, everything she'd been waiting for would be over in a matter of minutes. As she stood beside the boy she loved, she knew she'd never shared anything more magical with anyone. An hour later, after excitedly reliving the hatching in detail,
Ronnie and Will said goodnight to the others from the aquarium as they headed toward their cars. Aside from the trench, all evidence of what had happened was gone. Even the shells were nowhere in sight. Todd had gathered them up because he wanted to study the thickness of the shells and test for the possible presence of chemicals. As she walked beside him, Will slipped his arm around her. "I hope that was all you thought it would be." "It was even better," she said. "But I keep thinking about the baby turtles."
"They'll be okay."
"Not all of them."
"No," he admitted. "Not all of them. When they're young, the odds are stacked against them."
They walked a few steps in silence. "That makes me sad."
"It's the circle of life, right?"
"I don't need philosophy from the Lion King right now," she sniffed.
"I need you to lie to me."
"Oh," he said easily. "In that case, they're all going to make it, all 56 of them. They'll grow larger and mate and make little baby turtles and eventually pass away from old age after living far longer than most turtles, of course."
"Do you really think so?"
"Of course," he said confidently.
"They're our babies. They're special."
She was still laughing when she saw her dad step out onto the back porch with Jonah.
"Okay, after all the ridiculous buildup," Jonah started, "and watching the whole thing from start to finish, I just have one thing to say."
"What's that?"
Will prompted.
Jonah grinned broadly.
"That was so cool."
Ronnie laughed, remembering. At Will's puzzled expression, she just shrugged.
"Private joke," she said.
And in that instant, her dad coughed. It was a loud, wet cough, sounding sick. But just as had happened in the church, it didn't stop with one cough. He coughed again and again, one racking sound followed by another. She watched as her dad grabbed the rail to keep his balance. She could see Jonah's brow furrowing with worry and fear, and even Will was frozen in place. She watched her father try to stand straighter, arching his back, struggling to control the hacking. He brought both hands to his mouth and coughed one more time, and when at last he drew a ragged breath, it sounded almost as if he were breathing through water. He gasped again, then lowered his hands. For what seemed like the longest few seconds of her life, Ronnie was frozen in place, suddenly more scared than she'd ever been. Her father's face was covered in blood.
Chapter 30. Steve. He received his death sentence in February, while sitting in a doctor's office, only an hour after giving his last piano lesson. He'd started teaching again when he'd first moved back to Wrightsville Beach, after failing as a concert pianist. Pastor Harris, without consulting him, had brought a promising student to the house a few days after Steve had moved in and asked that Steve do him a favor. It was just like Pastor Harris to realize that by returning home, Steve was broadcasting the fact that he was lost and alone, and that the only way to help him was to bring a sense of purpose back into his life. The student was Chan Lee. Both her parents taught music at UNC Wilmington, and at 17 she was a wonderful technician, but she somehow lacked the ability to make the music her own. She was both serious and engaging, and Steve took to her immediately. She listened with interest and worked hard at incorporating his suggestions. He looked forward to her visits, and for Christmas he gave her a book on the construction of classical pianos, something he thought she would enjoy. But despite the joy he felt in teaching again, he found himself increasingly tired. The lessons drained him when they should have given him energy. For the first time in his life, he began to take regular naps. Over time, he began to take longer naps, up to 2 hours at a time, and when he woke, he often felt pain in his stomach. One evening, while cooking chili for dinner, He suddenly felt a sharp, stabbing pain and doubled over, knocking the pan from the stove, strewing tomatoes and beans and beef across the kitchen floor. As he tried to catch his breath, he knew something was seriously wrong. He made an appointment with a doctor, then went back to the hospital for scans and x-rays. Afterward, while Steve watched the vials fill with the blood necessary for the recommended tests, he thought of his father and the cancer that had eventually killed him. And he suddenly knew what the doctor would tell him. On the third visit to the doctor, he found out he was right. "You have stomach cancer," the doctor said. He took a long breath. "And from the scans, it's metastasized to your pancreas and lungs." His voice was neutral, but not unkind. "I'm sure you have a lot of questions, but let me start by saying it's not good." The oncologist was compassionate and yet was telling Steve that there was nothing he could do. Steve knew this, just as he knew the doctor wanted him to ask specific questions in the hope that talking might somehow make things easier. When his dad was dying, Steve had done his research. He knew what it meant when cancer metastasized. He knew what it meant to have cancer not only in his stomach, but also in his pancreas. He knew the odds of surviving were next to nil. And instead of asking anything, he turned toward the window. On the ledge, a pigeon was settled near the glass, oblivious to what was going on inside. "I've been told that I'm dying," he thought while staring at it. "And the doctor wants me to talk about it. But there's nothing really to say, is there?" He waited for the bird to coo in agreement, but of course, there was no response from the bird at all. "I'm dying," he thought again. Steve remembered clasping his hands together, amazed that they weren't shaking. If ever they should shake, he thought, it would be at a time like this. But they were as steady and as still as a kitchen sink. "How much time do I have?" The doctor seemed relieved that the silence had been broken at last. "Before we start going into that, I want to talk about some of your options." "There are no options," Steve said. "You and I both know that." If the doctor was surprised by his response, he didn't show it. "There are always options," he said. "But none that can cure it. You're talking about quality of life." The doctor set aside his clipboard. "Yes," he said. "How can we discuss quality if I don't know how much time I have? If I only have a few days, it might mean that I should start making phone calls." "You have more than a few days." "Weeks?" "Yes, of course." "Months?" The doctor hesitated. He must have seen something in Steve's face that signaled he would continue to press until he knew the truth. He cleared his throat. "I've been doing this a long time, and I've come to learn that predictions don't mean much. Too much lies outside the realm of medical knowledge. A lot of what happens next comes down to you and your specific genetics, your attitude." "No, there's nothing we can do to stop the inevitable, but that's not the point." "The point is that you should try to make the most of the time you have left." Steve studied the doctor, aware that his question hadn't been answered. "Do I have a year?" This time the doctor didn't respond, but his silence gave him away. Leaving the office, Steve took a deep breath, armed with the knowledge that he had less than 12 months to live. The reality hit him later as he was standing on the beach. He had advanced cancer, and there was no known cure. He would be dead within the year. On his way out of the office, the doctor had given him some information. Little pamphlets and a list of websites, useful for a book report, but good for little else. Steve had tossed them in the garbage on the way to the car. As he stood beneath the winter sun on the deserted beach, he tucked his hands into his coat, staring at the pier. Though his vision wasn't what it once was, he could see people moving about or fishing by the rails, and he marveled at their normalcy. It was as if nothing extraordinary had happened. He was going to die, and sooner rather than later. With that, he realized that so many of the things he'd spent time worrying about no longer mattered. His 401k plan? Won't need it. A way to make a living in his 50s? Doesn't matter. His desire to meet someone new and fall in love? Won't be fair to her, and to be frank, that desire ended with the diagnosis anyway. It was over, he repeated to himself. In less than a year, he was going to die. Yes, he'd known something was wrong, and perhaps he'd even expected the doctor to deliver the news he had. But the memory of the doctor speaking the actual words began to recur in his mind, like an old-fashioned record skipping on a turntable. On the beach, he began to shake. He was scared, and he was alone. Head lowered, he put his face into his hands and wondered why it had happened to him. The following day, he called Chan and explained that he could no longer teach piano. Next, he met with Pastor Harris to tell him the news. At that time, Pastor Harris was still recovering from the injuries he'd suffered in the fire, and though Steve knew it was selfish to burden his friend during his convalescence, he could think of no one else to talk to. He met him at the house, and as they sat on the back porch, Steve explained his diagnosis. He tried to keep the emotion out of his voice, but he failed, and in the end, they cried together. Afterward, Steve walked the beach, wondering what to do with the little time he had remaining. What, he wondered, was most important to him? Passing by the church, to that point the repairs hadn't been started, but the blackened walls had been torn down and hauled away. He stared at the gaping hole that once housed the stained glass window, thinking of Pastor Harris and the countless mornings he'd spent in the halo of sunlight as it streamed through the window. It was then that he knew he had to make another. A day later, he called Kim. When he told her the news, she broke down on the phone, weeping into the receiver. Steve felt a tightness in the back of his throat, but he didn't cry with her, and somehow he knew he would never cry about his diagnosis again. Later, he called her again to ask whether the kids could spend the summer with him. Though the idea frightened her, she consented. At his request, she agreed not to tell them about his condition. It would be a summer filled with lies, but what choice did he have if he wanted to get to know them again? In the spring, as the azaleas were blooming, he began to muse more often on the nature of God. It was inevitable, he supposed, to think about such things at a time like this. Either God existed or he didn't. He would either spend eternity in heaven, or there would be nothing at all. Somehow he found comfort in turning the question over in his mind. It spoke to a longing deep inside him. He eventually came to the conclusion that God was real, but he also wanted to experience God's presence in this world, in mortal terms. And with that, he began his quest. It was the last year of his life. Rain fell almost daily, making it one of the wettest springs on record. May, however, was absolutely dry, as if somewhere the faucet had been turned off. He purchased the glass he needed and began to work on the window. In June, his children arrived. He'd walked the beach and searched for God, and somehow he realized he'd been able to mend the fraying ropes that had tethered him to his children. Now, on a dark night in August, baby turtles were skimming the surface of the ocean, and he was coughing up blood. It was time to stop lying. It was time to tell the truth. His children were scared, and he knew they wanted him to say or do something to take their fear away. But his stomach was being pierced by 1,000 twisting needles. He wiped the blood from his face using the back of his hand and tried to sound calm. I think, he said, I need to go to the hospital.
Chapter 31. Ronnie. Her dad was hooked up to an IV in a hospital bed when he told her.
She immediately began to shake her head. It wasn't true. It couldn't be true.
No, she said. This isn't right. Doctors make mistakes.
Not this time, he said, reaching for her hand. And I'm sorry you had to find out like this.
Will and Jonah were downstairs in the cafeteria. Her dad wanted to talk to each of his children separately. But Ronnie suddenly wanted nothing to do with any of it. She didn't want him to say anything else, not one word more. Her mind flashed on a dozen different images. Suddenly, she knew why her dad had wanted her and Jonah to come to North Carolina. And she understood that her mom had known the truth all along. With so little time left together, he had no desire to argue with her. And his ceaseless work on the window now made perfect sense. She recalled his coughing fit in the church and the times he'd winced in pain. In hindsight, the pieces all fit together, yet everything was falling apart. He would never see her married. He would never hold a grandchild. The thought of living the rest of her life without him was almost too much to bear. It wasn't fair. None of this was fair at all. When she spoke, her words sounded brittle. When were you going to tell me?
I don't know.
Before I left? Or after I was back in New York? When he didn't answer, she could feel the blood rising in her cheeks. She knew she shouldn't be angry, but she couldn't help it. What? Were you planning to tell me on the phone? What were you going to say? Oh, sorry I didn't mention this when we were together last summer, but I have terminal cancer. How's it going with you?
Ronnie.
If you weren't going to tell me, why did you bring me down here? So I could watch you die?
No, sweetie. Just the opposite.
He rolled his head to face her.
I asked you to come so I could watch you live.
At his answer, she felt something shake loose inside, like the first pebbles skittering downhill before an avalanche. In the corridor, she heard two nurses walking past, their voices hushed. The fluorescent lights hummed overhead, casting a bluish pall over the walls. The IV dripped steadily. Normal scenes from any hospital, but there was nothing normal about any of this. Her throat felt as thick and sticky as paste, and she turned away, willing the tears not to come.
I'm sorry, sweetheart, he continued. I know I should have told you, but I wanted a normal summer, and I wanted you to have a normal summer. I just wanted to get to know my daughter again. Can you forgive me?
His plea cut her to the core, and she let out an involuntary cry. Her father was dying, and he wanted her forgiveness? There was something so pitiful in that, and she didn't know how to respond. As he waited, he reached over, and she took his hand.
Of course I forgive you,
she said, and it was then she began to cry. She leaned toward him, resting her head on his chest, and noticed how thin he'd become without her even being aware of it. She could feel the sharp outline of the bones in his chest, and she suddenly realized that he had been wasting away for months. It broke her heart to know she hadn't been paying attention. She'd been so caught up in her own life that she hadn't even noticed. When her dad put his arm around her, she began to cry harder, conscious that there would soon be a time when this simple act of affection would no longer be possible. Despite herself, she remembered the day she'd arrived at his house and the anger she'd felt toward him. She remembered storming off, the thought of touching him as alien to her as space travel. She'd hated him then, and she loved him now. She was glad she finally knew his secret, even as she wished she didn't. She felt him running his fingers through her hair. There would come a time when he would no longer be able to do this, when he would no longer be around. And she squeezed her eyelids shut, trying to block out the future. She needed more time with him. She needed him to listen as she whined,
She needed him to forgive her when she made mistakes. She needed him to love her the way he had this summer. She needed all of it, forever. And she knew it wouldn't happen. She allowed her dad to hold her and wept like the child she no longer was. Later, he answered her questions. He told her about his father and the history of cancer in his family. He told her about the pains he'd begun to feel as the new year rolled in. He told her that radiation was not an option because the disease was present in so many of his organs. As he spoke the words, she imagined the malignant cells moving from one spot in his body to the next, a marauding army of evil that left destruction in its wake. She asked about chemotherapy, and again his answer was the same. The cancer was aggressive, and while chemotherapy might help slow the disease, it couldn't stop it, and it would leave him feeling worse than if he'd done nothing at all. He explained the concept of quality of life, and as he did, she hated him for not telling her earlier. Yet she knew he'd made the right decision. Had she known, the summer would have unfolded differently. Their relationship would have taken a different course, and she didn't want to think what it might have become. He was pale, and she knew the morphine was making him sleepy. "Does it still hurt?" she asked. "Not like it did. It's better," he assured her. She nodded. She tried again not to think about the malignant cells invading his organs. "When did you tell Mom?" "In February, right after I found out. But I asked her not to tell you." Ronnie tried to remember how her mom had acted back then. She had to have been upset, but either Ronnie couldn't remember or she hadn't been paying attention. As usual, she'd been thinking only about herself. She wanted to believe she was different now, but she knew that wasn't completely true. Between work and spending time with Will, she'd spent relatively little time with her dad, and time was the only thing she could never get back. "But if you told me, I would have been around more. We could have seen more of each other. I could have helped you so you wouldn't be so tired all the time. Just knowing you were here was more than enough." "But maybe you wouldn't have ended up in the hospital." He reached for her hand. "Or maybe watching you enjoy a carefree summer while you fell in love was what kept me out of the hospital in the first place." Though he didn't say as much, she knew he didn't expect to live much longer, and she tried to imagine life without him. If she hadn't come to stay with him, if she hadn't given him a chance, it might have been easier to let him go. But she had, and nothing about what was happening was going to be easy. In the eerie quiet, she was able to hear his labored breathing, and she noticed again how much weight he'd lost. She wondered whether he would live until Christmas, or even long enough for her to visit again. She was alone, and her father was dying, and there was absolutely nothing she could do to stop it. "What's going to happen?" she asked him. He hadn't slept long, maybe 10 minutes before he'd rolled to her. "I'm not sure what you mean." "Will you have to stay in the hospital?" It was the one question she had been afraid to ask. While he dozed, she held his hand, imagining that he would never leave this place, that he'd spend the rest of his life in this room that smelled of disinfectant, surrounded by nurses who were no more than strangers. "No," he said. "I'll probably be home in a few days." He smiled. "At least I hope so." She squeezed his hand. "And then what? Once we're gone?" He thought about it. "I suppose I'd like to see the window completed and finish the song I started. I still think there's something special there." She scooted her chair closer. "I mean, who's going to make sure you're okay?" He didn't answer right away, but tried to sit up a little in the bed. "I'll be fine," he said,
And if I need something, I can call Pastor Harris. He lives only a couple of blocks away. She tried to imagine Pastor Harris, with his burned hands and his cane, trying to aid her father if he needed help getting into the car. He seemed to know what she was thinking. "Like I said, I'll be okay," he murmured. "I've known this was coming. And if worst comes to worst, there's a hospice associated with the hospital." She didn't want to imagine him there, either. "A hospice? It's not as bad as you think. I've even been there." "When?" "A few weeks ago. And I went back again last week. They'll be ready for me whenever I need it." Yet another thing she didn't know. Yet another secret revealed. Yet another truth pretending the inevitable. Her stomach roiled, nausea settling in. "But you'd rather be at home, wouldn't you?" "I will be," he said. "Until you can't?" His expression was almost too sad to bear. "Until I can't." She left her father's room, heading for the cafeteria. It was time, her dad said, for him to talk to Jonah. She was dazed as she walked the corridors. It was almost midnight now, but the emergency room was as busy as always. She passed by rooms, most of them with open doors, and saw crying children accompanied by anxious parents and a woman who couldn't stop vomiting. Nurses bustled around the main station, reaching for charts or loading up carts. It amazed her that so many people could be sick this late at night, yet she knew that most of them would be gone by tomorrow. Her dad, on the other hand, was scheduled to be moved to a room upstairs. They were only waiting for the paperwork to go through. She weaved through the crowded waiting room toward a door that led to the main area of the hospital lobby and the cafeteria. As the door swung shut behind her, the noise level dropped. She could hear the sound of her footfalls, could almost hear herself thinking. And as she moved, she felt waves of exhaustion and nausea coursing through her. This was the place where sick people came. This was the place where people came to die. And she knew her father would see this place again. She could barely swallow as she reached the cafeteria. She rubbed her gritty, swollen eyes, promising herself that she was going to keep it together. The grill was closed at this hour, but there were still vending machines on the far wall, and a couple of nurses sat in the corner, sipping coffee. Jonah and Will were seated at a table near the door, and Will looked up as she approached. On the table stood a half-empty bottle of water and milk and a packet of cookies for Jonah. Jonah turned around to look at her. "That took you long enough," he said. "What's going on? Is Dad okay?" "He's doing better," she said. "But he wants to talk to you." "About what?" He put down his cookie. "I'm not in trouble, am I?" "No, nothing like that. He wants to tell you what's going on." "Why can't you tell me?" He sounded anxious, and Ronnie felt her heart contract with dread. "Because he wants to talk to you alone, like he did with me. I'll walk you over there and wait outside the door, okay?" He got up from his seat and headed for the door, leaving her to trail after him. "Cool," he said as he passed her, and Ronnie suddenly wanted to run away. But she had to stay with Jonah. Will continued to sit, unmoving, his eyes fixed on Ronnie. "Give me a second, okay?" she called to Jonah. Will stood up from the table, looking frightened for her. "He knows," she suddenly thought. "Somehow he already knows." "Can you wait for us?" Ronnie began. I know you probably..." "Of course I'll wait," he said quietly. "I'll be right here for as long as you need me." Relief rushed through her, and she gave him a grateful look, then turned and followed Jonah. They pushed open the door and headed into the otherwise empty corridor toward the hustle and bustle of the emergency room. No one close to her had ever died.
though her dad's parents had died, and she remembered attending the funerals. She'd never known them well. They weren't the kind of grandparents that visited. They were strangers in a way. And even after they'd passed away, she'd never remembered missing them. About the closest she'd ever come to something like this was when Amy Childress, her seventh grade history teacher, was killed in a traffic accident the summer after Ronnie had finished taking her class. She'd heard about it first from Kayla, and she remembered feeling less sad than shocked, if only because Amy was so young. Miss Childress was still in her 20s and had been teaching only a few years. And Ronnie remembered how surreal it had felt. She was always so friendly. She was one of the few teachers Ronnie ever had that used to laugh aloud in class. When she returned to school in the fall, she wasn't sure what to expect. How did people react to something like this? What did the other teachers think? She walked the halls that day, searching for signs of anything different. But aside from a small plaque that had been mounted on the wall near the principal's office, she saw nothing out of the ordinary. Teachers taught their classes and socialized in the lounge. She saw Mrs. Taylor and Mr. Burns, two of the teachers Miss Childress often ate lunch with, smiling and laughing as they walked down the halls. She remembered that it bothered her. Granted, the accident had occurred over the summer and people had already mourned, but when she went by Miss Childress's classroom and saw that it was now being used to teach science, she realized she was angry. Not only that Miss Childress had died, but that her memory had been erased so entirely in such a short period of time. She didn't want that to happen to her dad. She didn't want him forgotten in a matter of weeks. He was a good man, a good father, and he deserved more than that. Thinking along those lines made her realize something else, too. She'd never really known her dad when he was healthy. She'd last spent time with him when she was a freshman in high school. Now, she was technically an adult, old enough to vote or join the army, and over the summer, he'd harbored his secret. Who would he have been had he not known what was happening to him? Who was he, really? She had nothing to judge him by other than memories of him as her piano teacher. She knew little about him. She didn't know the novelists he liked to read. She didn't know his favorite animal. And if pressed, she couldn't begin to guess his favorite color. They weren't the important things, and she knew they didn't really matter. But somehow, she was troubled by the thought that she would probably never learn the answers. Behind the door, she heard the sounds of Jonah crying, and she knew he'd learned the truth. She heard her brother's frantic denials and the answering murmurs of her father. She leaned against the wall, aching for Jonah and for herself. She wanted to do something to make this nightmare go away. She wanted to turn back the clock to the moment the turtles had hatched, when all was right with the world. She wanted to stand beside the boy she loved, her happy family by her side. She suddenly remembered Megan's radiant expression when she danced with her father at the wedding, and she felt a piercing ache at the knowledge that she and her dad would never share that special moment. She closed her eyes and put her hands over her ears, trying to block out the sound of Jonah's cries. He sounded so helpless, so young, so scared. There was no way he could understand what was happening. There was no way he would ever really recover. She knew he'd never forget this awful day.
"Can I get you a glass of water?"
She barely heard the words, but somehow knew they were directed at her. Looking up through her tears, she saw Pastor Harris standing before her. She couldn't answer, but she was somehow able to shake her head. His expression was kind, but she could see his anguish in the stoop of his shoulders, in the way he gripped the cane.
"I'm very sorry," he said.
His voice sounded weary.
"I can't imagine how hard this is for you. Your dad is a special man."
She nodded.
"How did you know he was here? Did he call you?"
"No,
he said.
One of the nurses called me. I'm here 2 or 3 times a week, and when you brought him in, they thought I'd want to know. They know I think of him as my son.
Are you going to talk to him? Pastor Harris eyed the closed door.
Only if he wants to see me.
By his pained expression, she knew he could hear Jonah's cries.
And after talking to the two of you, I'm sure he will. You have no idea how much he was dreading this moment.
You've talked about it?
Many times. He loves the two of you more than life itself. And he didn't want to hurt you. He knew the time would come, but I'm sure he didn't want you to find out like this.
It doesn't matter. It's not like it changes anything.
But everything has changed,
Pastor Harris countered. Because I know?
No, he said. Because of the time you've spent together. Before the two of you came down here, he was so nervous. Not about being sick, but because of how much he wanted to spend time with you and wanted everything to go well. I don't think you realize how much he missed you or how much he really loves you and Jonah. He was literally counting the days. When I see him, he'd say, 19 days or 12 days. And the day before you arrived, he spent hours cleaning the house and putting new sheets on the beds. I know the place isn't much, but if you'd seen it before, you'd understand. He wanted the two of you to have a summer to remember, and he wanted to be part of that. Like all parents, he wants you to be happy. He wants to know that you're going to be okay. He wants to know that you'll make good decisions. That's what he needed this summer. And that's what you've given him.
She squinted up at him. But I haven't always made good decisions. Pastor Harris smiled.
All that shows is that you're human. He never expected perfection. But I do know how proud he is of the young woman you've become. He told me that just a few days ago, and you should have seen him when he spoke about you. He was so proud, so happy. And that night when I prayed, I thank God for that, because your dad really struggled when he moved back here. I wasn't sure he'd ever be happy again. And yet, despite everything that's happened, I now know that he is.
She felt the lump in her throat. What am I supposed to do?
I'm not sure there's anything you can do.
But I'm scared, she said. And my dad?
I know, he said. And though both of you have made him very happy, I know your dad is scared too.
That night, Ronnie stood on the back porch. The waves were as steady and rhythmic as always, and the stars were flickering with pinprick intensity. But everything else about the world around her seemed different. Will was talking with Jonah in the bedroom, so there were 3 people here as usual. But somehow the house felt emptier. Pastor Harris was still with her dad. Pastor Harris told her he planned to stay through the night so she could bring Jonah back home, but she felt guilty nonetheless for leaving. Tomorrow, her dad had tests scheduled during the day and another meeting with his doctor. In between those things, he would be tired and she knew he'd need his rest. But she wanted to be there. She wanted to be at his side, even if he was asleep, because she knew the time would come when she couldn't. Behind her, she heard the back door squeak open. Will closed it gently behind him. As he approached her, she continued to gaze out over the sandy beach.
Jonah's finally asleep, he said. But I don't think he really understands what's happening. He told me he's pretty sure the doctor will make his dad all better, and he kept asking when his dad could come home.
She remembered his cries from the hospital room, and all she could do was nod. Will slipped his arms around her.
Are you okay?
He asked. How do you think I'm doing?
I just found out my father is dying and that he probably won't live to see Christmas.
I know, he said gently. And I'm sorry. I know how hard this is for you.
She could feel his hands on her waist. I'll stay tonight, so if anything happens and you have to go, someone can be with Jonah.
I can stay around here as long as you need me to.
I know I'm supposed to be leaving in a couple of days, but I can call the dean's office and explain what's happening. Classes don't start until next week.
You can't fix this, she said. Though she could hear the sharpness in her tone, she couldn't help it.
Don't you get that?
I'm not trying to fix it.
Yes, you are, but you can't.
Her heart suddenly felt as if it were going to explode.
And you can't understand what I'm going through either.
I've lost someone too, he reminded her.
It's not the same. She squeezed the bridge of her nose, trying to stifle her tears. I was so mean to him. I quit the piano. I blamed him for everything. And I didn't say more than a few words to him for 3 years. 3 years. And I can't get those years back. But maybe, if I hadn't been so angry, he might not have gotten sick. Maybe I caused that extra stress that did all this. Maybe it was me.
She pulled away from Will. It's not your fault.
Will tried to take her back into his arms, but it was the last thing she wanted, and she tried to push him away. When he didn't let go, she pounded his chest.
Let me go! I can handle this alone!
But he still held her. And when she realized he wasn't going to let go, she finally collapsed into him. And for a long time, she let him hold her as she cried. Ronnie lay in her darkened bedroom, listening to the sound of Jonah breathing. Will was sleeping on the couch in the living room. She knew she should try to rest, but she kept waiting for the phone to ring. She imagined the worst, that her father had begun to cough again, that he'd lost more blood, that there was nothing anyone could do. Beside her, on the bedstand, was her father's Bible. Earlier, she glanced through it, unsure what she would find. Had he underlined passages or folded down pages? As she flipped through the book, she'd found few traces of her father, other than a well-worn feel to the pages that suggested a deep familiarity with nearly every chapter. She wished that he'd done something to make it his own, something that left behind clues about himself. But there was nothing even to suggest that he'd found one passage more interesting than another. She'd never read the Bible, but somehow she knew that she would read this one, searching for whatever meaning her father had found within the pages. She wondered if the Bible had been given to him by Pastor Harris, or whether he'd bought it on his own, and how long it had been in his possession. There was so much she didn't know about him, and she wondered now why she'd never bothered to ask him. But she would, she decided. If she soon would have only memories, then she wanted as many as she could collect. And as she found herself praying for the first time in years, she begged God for enough time to make it possible.
Chapter 32. Will. Will didn't sleep well. Throughout the night, he'd heard Ronnie tossing and turning and pacing in her room. He recognized the shock she was feeling. He remembered the numbness and guilt, the disbelief and anger after Mikey had died. The years had dulled the emotional intensity, but he could remember the conflicting desire for company and the need to be left alone. He felt sadness for Ronnie and also for Jonah, who was too young to grasp it at all, and even for himself. During the summer, Steve had been incredibly kind to him, as they'd spent a lot more time at Ronnie's than they had at his house. He liked the quiet way he cooked in the kitchen and the easy familiarity he shared with Jonah. He'd often seen the two of them out on the beach, flying kites or playing catch near the waves, or working on the stained glass window in quiet concentration. While most fathers liked to see themselves as the kind of men who made time for their kids, it seemed to Will that Steve was the real thing. In the short time he'd known him, he'd never once seen Steve get angry, never heard him raise his voice. He supposed that it could have had something to do with the fact that he knew he was dying, but Will didn't think that explained everything. Ronnie's dad was just a good man, at peace with himself and others. He loved his kids and somehow trusted that they were usually smart enough to make the right decisions. As he lay on the couch, he reflected that he wanted to be the same kind of father someday. Though he loved his dad, he hadn't always been the easygoing man Ronnie had met. There were long stretches of Will's life during which he hardly remembered seeing his father as he worked to grow his business. Add in his mom's occasional volatility and the death of Mikey, which sent the entire family into depression for a couple of years, and there had been times when he wished he'd been born into a different family. He knew he was lucky, and it was true that things had been a lot better lately. But growing up hadn't been all cupcakes and parties, and he could remember wishing for a different life. But Steve was an altogether different kind of parent. Ronnie had told him that he would sit with her for hours as she learned to play the piano, but in all the time he'd been at the house, he'd never heard Steve talk about it. He hadn't even mentioned it in passing, and though at first Will thought it odd, he began to see it as a powerful indication of his love for Ronnie. She didn't want to talk about it, so he didn't, even though it had been a major part of their life together. He'd even boarded up the alcove because she didn't want to be reminded of it. What kind of person would do that? Only Steve, a man he'd grown to admire, a man he'd learned from, and the kind of man he himself hoped to be as he grew older. He was awakened by the morning sunlight streaming through the living room windows, and he stretched before rising to his feet. Peeking down the hall, he saw that the door to Ronnie's room was open, and he knew that she was already awake. He found her on the porch in the same spot as the night before. She didn't turn around. "Good morning," he said. Her shoulders sagged as she turned toward him. "Good morning," she said, offering the slightest of smiles. She opened her arms, and he wrapped himself around her, grateful for the embrace. "I'm sorry about last night," she said. "There's no reason to be sorry." He nuzzled her hair. "You didn't do anything wrong." She said. "But thanks anyway. I didn't hear you get up." "I've been up for a while," she sighed. "I called the hospital and talked to my dad. Though he didn't say as much, I could tell he's still in a lot of pain. He thinks they might keep him for a couple of days before his tests are done." In almost any other situation, he would have assured her that everything would be fine, that it would all work out. But in this case, they both knew the words would mean nothing. Instead, he leaned forward, resting his forehead against hers. "Were you able to get any sleep? I heard you wandering around last night." "Not really. I finally crawled in bed with Jonah, but my brain just wouldn't shut off. But not just because of what's going on with my dad," she paused. "It was because of you, too. You're leaving in a couple of days." "I already told you I could postpone it."